You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Are you looking forward to reading some good books this summer? Well, we have Daniel Goldenback with us to share some of his favorites. He's the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. And by the way, we do have the list of all the books that Daniel's going to mention today on our website. So you just go to WPR.org/Larry and it will be under today's program note. What book would you like to recommend for your summer reading list? What genre do you prefer to read in the summer? Well, be part of our conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks, Jill. It's great to be here.
I figured if Larry's going to go on vacation, I was going to steal you to be able to host the show.
We usually chat off the air, it's nice to talk to you online.
Yeah, that'll teach him for going on vacation. Anyway, I'm always excited to read your list. Before we kind of get to it, though, let's talk about you for a second. For those who aren't familiar, tell us about Boswell Books.
Boswell's a bookstore in Milwaukee on the Upper East Side, officially.
Yeah.
And we've been around for 16 years, and we're in a space that we're on a block that's had a bookstore for 100 years, off and on. We took over from the old Harry W. Schwartz Bookshops, one location. And our booksellers have worked at other bookstores, many have gone on to other bookstores, and quite a number of them are librarians now, and they all love to read in different kind of genres, and most of them like to recommend things too. Sometimes some people keep their reads to themselves. Readers are an introverted bunch. So it's a new skill set. Like the skill set to read is very different from the skill set to tell somebody about the book.
That's really true. I suppose those people don't go to book clubs then either. They don't want to share.
Yeah, it's a range. I mean, we have four book clubs that Boswell runs, and I never went to a book club before I ran it. I ran one in Mequon, a suburb of Milwaukee, 30 years ago, and then that was done when I wasn't a manager, and I didn't run one again until 2009. And they're hard to start. It takes some momentum. It takes people who want to read similar books or are adventurous, and some of the people are in no other book club, and then there's the book club crazed people who are in like five.
Oh my gosh. How do you do that? That's a lot to digest in 1 month. It's because they usually meet every month, right?
Most meet every month, yeah. Mm-hmm. They take a summer break or winter break or something like that. Mm-hmm. I find that it just throws other things out of out of the game plan. Some are retired, but shockingly enough, some are not.
Well, more power to them. That's great. We were chatting before we started about some of the authors that you had in your store. I mean, you host authors all the time.
We do. And everything from books that authors have published themselves to some of the bigger names. We're lucky enough to get on some of the national tours. We just hosted Christopher Moore, who writes these speculative thriller comedies. Some are contemporary, some have vampires, some don't have vampires. His new book is about The Bride of Frankenstein, Freud, Jung, Egon Schiele, a number of historical characters who all seem to be in Vienna at the same time.
How do you decide who gets to come?
Well, we write pitches, and Chris in our office writes. He is our major pitch master. Some we have existing relationships with, and but for the bigger names, so sometimes a publicist will say to us, I really want this author to come to Milwaukee. So, for example, when we had Frederick Bachman for his new book, My Friends. We had written a pitch, but she had decided that this was going to be a tour that focused on the Midwest and South, which are sometimes don't get as many authors as the East Coast. I say to some people, if there's certain publishers, I won't give their names out, but if you think that author is going to come to the Midwest, maybe Chicago, probably nowhere else. They're just going to go up the East Coast and then to the West Coast. Mm-hmm. I want to say Christopher Moore's new book is called Anima Rising. It doesn't stick in my head that well, so I took a moment to remember.
A lot of things don't stick in my head, so I feel your pain.
But sometimes it's sort of like an author will say, I grew up in Milwaukee and I really want to come back, or my best friend shops at your store, or you know my mother, and that's... kind of more common than you think.
Well, we kind of get the same thing. So yeah. We understand. You know, we get a lot of the, oh, I listen to your show all the time and I just wrote this book.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they're fantastic and they fit right in. Other times they don't quite fit what we do, but we always appreciate it. We love to hear about
it. And
them.
Sometimes when the person's on the show, you realize, oh, they've actually never heard the show before after all.
That never happens. I don't know what you're talking about, Daniel. All right. Well, when you go through and you decide to put books on your summer reading list, what are you kind of looking for in general?
Well, I do read a good amount. Less than our buyer, but more than probably I would maybe if I didn't work in a bookstore. It's about 8 to 9 books a month.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. And it does mean people say, when do you read? Not at night because I fall asleep. I could only finish a really exciting book at night. It's like I get up. I'm older. I get up really early in the morning. And so before like my day starts, it'll be like, you know, at 5 in the morning or something like that. I'll say, oh, I got an hour or two to read. Mm-hmm. Or I like to read on one of my days off. And I like to walk and read when the weather's right. And people are afraid. And people used to think it was freakish. But now they're all on their phones while they walk.
True.
And so they're not paying attention either. So I get less criticism for it. But I was thinking I wanted new books. You know, it's a summer reading segment, so most of the things were April to June, but I haven't really talked about some of these books since last holiday, and so there's a few books that came out in February.
Okay.
I'm always looking for most of the books I read are fiction, I guess, but I do really like reading nonfiction. The thing is that many of the things we read in advance copies, which are still these physical galleys that are sent to us, publishers have been pushing really hard for us to read digitally. It would save them a lot of money. During COVID, it was a big push, but it didn't work, especially with some of the older booksellers. They couldn't get the recommendations that they wanted. And I really try when I finish a book, if I like it and I know I can have any chance of selling it, I try to write something up because it makes a lot of people happy. But I will be frank and say that I don't finish most of the books I start.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a skill that I've had to learn over the years. Like, I get to 25 pages and I think, oh, nobody's going to be helped by me reading this.
Yeah, well, that comes with experience for sure. Yeah, I mean,
it's life lesson.
Yeah, you got to judge because there aren't so many out there. So, well, I'm glad you judged the 20 that we will be talking about today. And let's start off with The Paris Express by Emma Donoghue. It's set in the 1890s in France, and it's based on a real incident. So, what
yes. So I kind of grouped some historical fiction together, which is something I really like talking about. I feel like it's good for discussions because there's always the historical elements. Emma Donoghue actually got the idea for this book from a photograph, a famous photograph of a plane, a train, sad to say, crashed. But it's not too hard to know what the ending is. And she is a wonderful writer. Emma Donoghue, who's written a lot of books, including Room, which was a big film. But most of her books are actually historicals. And she wrote a book during COVID. It just happened to come out at the beginning of the COVID about the 1918 flu. And so so that one did pretty well.
I'll bet.
So this is about a train from Granville to Paris and all the passengers on it. This is at the beginning of higher speed train travel. And it's a wonderful story following people from the different classes. Because one thing that's interesting is the trains are set up in the cars. So you have the wealthy people and the middle class people and the poor people. And they're all doing interesting things. All the people in the book, almost all the people are real. Some of them were on the train. Some of them she imagined could have been on the train.
Ah.
And one of them has a bomb. Just to make things exciting.
It's a wonderful premise.
Yeah.
What a great idea.
And I love the way the book is really fast moving, like a speeding train. So.
And again, the name of it was The Paris Express by Emma Donahue. Next up, we have another historical fiction. It's 33 Plays Bergman by Alan Austin. So what's this one about?
So Alice Austin is a interesting person. She lives in Milwaukee area suburbs, and she's a pretty well-regarded playwright and she award-winning filmmaker who'd been working on this book for a long time. She lived in Belgium. And she decided to set a World War II novel in Belgium. Every country, every area has their own story of resistance and the war. And Brussels, Belgium is no different. It's set in one apartment building where in the middle of the night, a family disappears, as well as their art collection. The story jumps from apartment to apartment as you follow the story along. People who become soldiers, people who might be spies, or people who are students, people falling in love. It's very old-fashioned kind of big novel. It's done incredibly well in Europe, needless to say. But actually, it's been very popular, too. I know it was Ann Patchett's first edition book club. And she does just a really wonderful job sort of. I love multi-character novels, like from different perspectives, but it all kinds of comes together in the big story. You find out what happened to everything. 33 plus Brugman. Oh, and it's based on the apartment building she lived in Brussels.
Yeah, I had read a review about that, and it does sound really interesting. It kind of, I thought when I read that review that, she must have watched Murders in the Building. It's kind of got that same kind of, here's what's going on in this building. Yeah, so yeah. Very cool.
You can see the mat, like in a like some sort of broadcast, like the mat, the camera moving from
yes,
room to
room,
room
to
and
room.
The map.
Yeah. Okay, the next book, now this one hasn't been released yet, and it's called The Listeners by Megan Stiefvater.
Uh-huh.
Stiefvater. Okay.
We had to actually listen to a video to get the pronunciation kind of right.
So, excellent.
And I do pronounce everything wrong because I mostly read it and I never deal with people in real life.
Yes.
So like the previous book, I like to make it's completely in my head, the difference, but I like to make a difference between historical fiction, where I feel like it's real life, real events, and period fiction, where it could have happened, but it's not really based on specific people.
Sure.
And so the premise of this book is it's set in a West Virginia resort that is not the Greenbrier. Mind you, it's not the Greenbrier.
Sure.
And the woman who's the manager of the resort, it is very glamorous. All the wealthy people go there in the summer because it's cooler. It's got the hot the springs and things like that. And the woman who runs the resort, whose name is June, is a local, even though it's owned by a very wealthy out-of-town family who just doesn't want to run the resort. And she knows how to make this place hum. And so you're starting to meet some of the workers and things like that. And then the government makes a deal with the family to house Axis diplomats and their servants and their staff. And they have to kick everybody out of the hotel, except for one person who refuses to go, who comes up with a good idea of how to stay there. And they put these people in, the Italians, Japanese people, Germans, who don't necessarily get along with each other. And she has to coordinate these diplomats who are not used to taking directions from anybody, along with an FBI agent who's also a local, who's running from a terrible tragedy in his past, of course. And they have to deal with escapes and people doing all sorts of, there might be spies and, you know, certainly fighting and things like that. And on top of that, because it's in West Virginia and there are springs, the water has a bit of a magical power to it. So there's a speculative, I usually try to have one speculative book. I would say this is pretty light on the speculative. If you are an older reader who likes historical fiction, you'll say, oh, and there's water that could heal or, you know, destroy. But if you're a younger person, you know Maggie from her YA Raven Boy series and a number of other books. She's got a huge fan base. But like many YA writers, this is very common. They're moving into adult fiction.
Sure.
And so this is sort of her transition. Unlike many writers, she's written like a very long essay on why she did it. But She's a good writer and she's a good speeder. And we're very lucky she's coming to Milwaukee. Ali, one of my booksellers, who's a huge fan, convinced me to read the book early because Ali was like, make a pitch. And I was like, I don't know how to make a pitch without reading the book. And so I listened to my booksellers, I read the book, and I loved it.
Okay.
And so we'll see. Advanced reviews are really good. It's not going to be for everybody, but I think it's going to be, I'm hoping it's be a lot of people, and I like to throw this in. It kind of has a Gentleman of Moscow vibe to it.
Ah, nice.
Which I haven't been able to say. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take place in Russia, though.
No, United States. Yeah. So. And again, it's called The Listeners, right?
That is right.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
All right. We are talking to Daniel Golden. He is the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. We are going to be getting to the next ones on his 20 list, I guess. So if you're interested in getting any information about any of the books or you have a recommendation of your own, we'd love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najeo. Just a reminder, our next book club novel is Bridgeton by Michael Nadler. The story follows three childhood friends who always find a way to come back and visit their hometown. Start reading now. We'll be talking about it on June 19th. But right now, we are talking to Daniel Golden. He's telling us what books we should be looking at to read this summer. So we just talked about The Listeners, and where are we here? We've got a middle grade novel for a young reader. It's called Max in the Land of Lies. That looks really interesting.
Well, it is a very interesting book. I do try to read one middle grade book a month. Sometimes I'm successful, sometimes I'm not. Sometimes it or YA, and some I do include old books in there. So I read, for example, this year, The Westing Game, which is a award-winning book that's set in Milwaukee that's kind of a mystery. And I also read When You Reach Me, which is a middle grade book that has a connection to Wrinkle in Time, because I read an interesting article about two books connected to it. So I'm going to read the other one next. But this was one that I really liked. It's actually a two-part book. It was one of those books that was too big for middle grade because there are rules. So they split it into two books. And this is the second book. The first book is called Max in the House of Spies. This is Max in the Land of Lies. And the other reason I mentioned it is there was a big article in the Wall Street Journal that many listeners might have seen about how World War II is incredibly hot with children's book writers. Alan Gratz, Jennifer Nielsen, Steve Scheinkin. The Bletchley Riddle was one of the biggest books of last year, which I also loved. And Adam Gidwitz is also in that. So this is about a boy who is on the Kinder transport, has to escape from Germany, lands in Great Britain, in England, and decides he wants to go back and save his family. And so he trains to be a spy. And the first book is about the training. And the second book is actually about the mission, where he sort of infiltrates a radio studio. It is super fun. I can certainly see adults crossing over into it, but read it with your kid, with your grandkid. That's what I always recommend for adults when if they're worried about content or stuff, read it along with them. And so you can either vet it or you can explain it or you can discuss it. And because they're often a little shorter, maybe you'll get your reading content that you wanted.
Yeah. I remember when Harry Potter first came out in England that it was starting to transfer over to adults, but they were embarrassed to read it, so they changed the book cover. So when they were reading it in public, people didn't know.
Yes. Well, I use the old childhood grocery bag that you fold up as a, you know, it protects the book.
It does. It protects
the books. But also it's like if there's something like, I would never read anything that was in bad taste or anything. But I don't want, sometimes like a cover can be misleading. You don't want to get the wrong idea. So
right.
You should always have one of those little bag things.
That's
on.
That's right. See, they prepared us for life when they taught us how to do that. So, so next is, here's our first nonfiction book. It's called Dinner with King Tut by Sam Keane. It sounds fascinating. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I love him. This is a is a little transition because it's a little historical fiction and a little science.
True.
So I discovered Sam Keen. His biggest book is Disappearing Spoon, which is still very popular after many years. But we did, for book club, I like to do at least one nonfiction book a year. We read a book called The Ice Pick Surgeon, which was a collection of essays about science crime. And really, really liked it. Had it on my rec shelf for a number of months. And so when this book came along, I had the opportunity to read it. It's about experimental archaeology, which is where contemporary amateurs and professionals try to duplicate the things that we dig up. So whether that's creating mummies or figuring out how to eat poisonous potatoes, any number of ideas. He looks in North America, China, Africa, Egypt, obviously. And what he does is each South America, each nonfiction element is ringed by like a fictional narrative of what could have happened. They're clever, almost like short stories. Some of them are a little disturbing, but really enjoyable. Hunting weapons and that kind of thing. And so people kind of duplicate. How do you make this? How would you make this weapon? Mm-hmm. I thought it was. I'm a little worried that the nonfiction reader will go, what are these stories? But all the advanced reviews have been really good.
Okay, so did he do all this himself, or is he just reporting?
This is what I love about him. He is like Mary Roach. This is completely for the Mary Roach reader. He goes in the field. Like, it's not COVID. You know, like, because some of these books during it, they were like, I would have gone, but I can't go, so here's some research. No. He actually goes to the places works with the amateurs and the professionals in these various labs and digs and libraries around the world, and firsthand often tries to duplicate it too. Sometimes successfully.
Sometimes successfully. Okay.
Dot dot dot
dot dot dot. That one really does sound interesting. I just love that whole premise for that book. So next up, we've got Run for the Hills by Kevin Wilson. Tell us about that one.
Well, I'm swerving, and this is sort of my, you know, my remarkable great creatures, man called Uva, like the sort of kind of upmarket book clubby fiction. I don't know what you'd call it, but I, you know, sort of literary, sort of contemporary, sort of, you know, accessible. There are certain themes, second chances, found family. There are things that I realize, for some reason, a lot of the characters have onset dementia, and I don't, which makes me always worried about myself, but my mom, you know, but it's something that, and people do say, why do you read these books with troubling issues? And it's like, it's a way to process it. There's no dementia in this book, but there is found family. It's about a woman who runs a farm, and she gets a visit from, it turns out, her half-brother, which she didn't know she had. She knows that her father left the family, and he says, not only do you have me, but there are other siblings around the country. So I'm sure you've heard these stories about men who have left sperm for lots and lots and lots of women, and people find out they have, like, you know, 50 siblings like that. Well, this is not through a sperm bank. This is real life. And it's such a it's like a mystery, because they're, each time the guy, her father, invents himself and he's a completely different person. And she winds up with all this family that is like her, but not like her. He wrote a book called The Family Fang, which had adapted to a film. And I read every book that comes out. I love that he always has kind of crazy premises involved. He had a book about children who spontaneously combust. But it was a heart warmer. They don't die when they combust. They just, the fire burns out.
Oh, well, okay. Then it's just,
it just can damage some furniture.
So don't invite them over for play dates. Because
Don't give away the plot.
Okay. That was called Run for the Hills, and that was by Kevin Wilson. Next up, we've got another road trip book. That's always a good premise for a book. It's called Bug Hollow, and then it's Michelle Hunnevin. Is that how they pronounce it?
Yeah, Bug Hollow. Yes, another sort of found family story in a way. Mm-hmm. It is a... I love one of my favorite writers. She wrote a book called Search that I loved, James Land that I loved, all lots of found family and friendships and philosophical musings. And one of her books was based on the varieties of religious experience, for example. This book is sort of a family saga, and it starts when the teenage son in the family decides to go on a road trip with his buddies before he goes off to college and then doesn't come back. And the family goes crazy and tries to rescue him with unforeseen results. And this plays out in the various parts of the family over, I don't know, many decades. She is wonderful about relationships and observations, which is something that I... You know, when you think about what you like about books, I like to read people who think of the world in an interesting way. She is so this is different from her other books because it is takes place over many years. But she does it in a way that I like, that I see in books sometimes, where you jump from one thing to time and to another, and you don't always you have to kind of guess what happened in between. Mm-hmm. Very warm, funny, sad, a little weepy. Anne Napolitano, who had a big bestseller with Hello Beautiful, she wrote a wreck. I'm just going to say Anne Napolitano Rex. She's now the queen of the Rex, the blurbs. but I'm convinced in my heart she reads all of them. And I will say, I almost never go wrong with her recommendations.
That's so nice.
I would say that's something to be said. The other thing that's really it's just heartbreaking, but also heartwarming, is this book is a love letter to Altadena, which had the fires earlier in the year. And Michelle has written about almost all her books have been set in that period. One of them was set in Pasadena, which really isn't that far away. It was also skirted the fire. Mm-hmm. Her house burned down in the fire. So it's sort of a love letter to, as did several of the notable buildings in the story. Mm. It was done before the fire, but it is, you know, there was a big Los Angeles Times story about it because of that. She did once get a shortlist for the National Book Award, but she really has never had a book that's truly broken out, despite my best efforts. And I think that this might be the one that does it. There's certainly, it's got like a Griffin Dunn. He wrote a memoir, so now he can blurb novels.
Oh, is that how that works? I was going to ask you. Okay, and it was Bug Hollow by Michelle Hunnevin.
Right.
Hunnevin. So all those blurbs. I mean, sometimes you pick up a book and that you can't even figure out what the book's about because there's so many of those blurbs. How did they get those?
It's a science.
Is it a science?
I'm glad you asked because there's big news that one of the big publishers has told authors they no longer have to solicit blurbs. And so that means all the other publishers make you solicit blurbs. So you basically have to go to everyone you know. Some come from the publisher. So you find out that, for example, Kevin Wilson has, I believe Shelby Van Pelt, one blurb the other. They have the same editor, Helen Asma. Sometimes the agent is in common. Sometimes the publisher is in common. Sometimes they went to the same writing program. I once got return message reply from an author that said, I'm sorry, I'm not able to blurb books for the next 2 years because I have all these things to do.
Sure.
But then she said to me, well, the deal is, you probably still have to blurb somebody if they're your student. But they're not going to email you. Like, they'll get the email back.
Sure.
Some authors are known for not blurbing, and some authors are known for blurbing and not having read the book.
Yeah.
But you can still use it to figure out what kind of book it is. Mm-hmm. So what I take issue with, well, I'm always a little weirded out when I don't know who any of the people are. But, Jill, there's a lot of people in the world.
There are
a lot of writers. We were just discussing this with your book club. Just in Wisconsin, but all over. Then you take the whole world? And there's too many. So yeah. I don't know everybody. But I get also when I read a book and I say, this blurb, you know, when I don't finish a book and I say, this isn't helping anyone, I don't know why this blurb is here. Mm-hmm. It's not like I don't connect the narratives. I don't. If I was that author's reader and I read this book, I think I'd be disappointed. But nobody listens to me.
Well, hopefully that'll change.
No, never. Never. I'm too old. Do you want to talk about the Satisfaction Cafe?
I would love to.
Oh, good.
Comes out in July.
It does. It is one of my later books. And I didn't have, you know, I like to keep my little books over here, but I did print the cover so I could look at it longingly. This is also in that found family kind of genre. And it also has an Ann Patchett quote on it. So
I saw that actually. And I'm like, oh, okay, both, that makes me interested.
We like that. We kind of overlap in taste. So as does most of the country. But not every. So this is a difference in that it's a Chinese immigrant narrative story. I really enjoyed Kathy Wang's earlier book called, not her last one, but the one called Family Trust, which was a family dysfunction kind of road trippy novel. And through that, I was, you know, I kind of kept my eye out. And so when the publisher kind of sent this to me, I wanted to read it. It's about a woman who immigrates from a very abusive family. Overcoming adversity is another thing in these stories. In Taiwan, she's not appreciated. She's the woman, so they wouldn't normally have sent her to school abroad, but something happens to her brother, and they have the money, and she's smart, and so they send her. And she winds up in the United States, where she marries quickly, and things don't really go well. And so the series of her endeavors as she goes through life, meeting people, meeting another man who has a lot of money, but maybe she's not in love with him, is sort of a search for what is happiness and what is sort of satisfaction. And I don't – one of the things that's tricky about this title is it sort of gives away what happens. You know, so there's books that where the author will say, please, no spoilers when you're talking to them, or don't talk about anything past page 50, or don't talk about anything. Why did you ask me what I ate for breakfast? But in this book, the title basically says, somebody's going to open a Satisfaction Cafe. It's a crazy concept. But I really liked it because it took that kind of second chances found family element and merged it with sort of an immigrant narrative, which made it really interesting. She's, I believe she has some tech background because her stories are generally set in Northern California. And I believe there's a little techiness in here, and there was certainly a lot of it in Family Trust. Mm-hmm. So very, very sort of fun. Not necessarily a heavy comedy, but you know, a lot of these books kind of have gentle humor too,
which is important.
They're like comforting, you know, like, you know.
Yeah, and I think you can relate a little bit more to them when there's something that's a little bit more funny in it.
Yeah, that's right.
That was Satisfaction Cafe by Kathy Wang, coming out on July 1st. Next, we have a memoir, How to Lose Your Mother by Molly Jong Fast. And it sounds kind of sad, is it?
Well, this is, I grouped it with those books because, well, this is not found family. This is family. And it is sad, but it's also, she's got a good sense of humor about things. And I read a decent amount of memoirs. One of my rules is I like the ones I like best, sort of observe, but don't judge, and let the reader sort of make the decisions. I feel the same way about novels. I was like, you can lay it out for me and I can make my decision. I don't love lectures that I could read a book that's a lecture for that. But that's, you know, sure. That's not the way books are. Some are, some aren't. So this is about Molly Jong Fast. I'm sure many of the listeners know, but some of the younger people won't know that she is the daughter of Erica Jong, who was a very, very famous author and personality in the 70s for writing about a novel that represented her free-spirited life. It was called Fear of Flying.
Yes.
She had a number of books afterwards, and she was a staple on the talk shows. She'd have I'm sure if she was living and was 25 today, she'd have a very strong social media following because she was effectively, aside from the book, she was famous for being famous.
Yes.
And she was not the greatest mom. And in fact, you know how many celebrities today keep their kids out of the spotlight? 50 years ago, you didn't do that. You sort of like you pushed them into the spotlight. She even wrote a children's book about Molly that that got adapted to a television show.
Oh, my gosh.
Not a successful one. Uh-huh. And they changed Molly's name. But still. So now her mom is older. She's married to on marriage number X. And they're both frail and maybe having some memory issues. But more than that, they're not famous anymore. And
yes.
This is the very special experience of the once famous. Like they have, because in a part of their heads, they're still famous. But nobody knows who they are.
Sunset Boulevard.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's twofold in this book because Molly's dad is the son of Howard Fast, who was a very famous novelist in the 50s and 60s, who by the end of his life was pretty obscure too. So they're divorced. You know, this is her first husband. So she can bond with her father over that. Otherwise, we don't get too much of the dad because this is mom's story. But her mom and Molly Jung is Fast is actually a pretty well-known political reporter now. So she is not done a neat, like she's done something very different from her parents. You know, you can't accuse her of Nepo, but she's written this book about her mom. So I guess a little.
A little bit. She'll get those fans. And that was How to Lose Your Mother was the name of that one. And we're talking with Daniel Golden. He's the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. If you have any recommendations, we'd love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I am here with Daniel Golden. He's the owner of Boswell Books, and we're talking about his top 20 books for summer reads. And we've been all over the map, and right now we're in memoir county. And the next one up is Who I Always Was by Teresa Okonkwo.
Okonkwo?
What? Okonkwo. Yes. It's O-K-O-N. I love that.
That is a Nigerian name. She is okay. The daughter of a Nigerian father and a Gambian mother.
Okay.
And this is memoir country. In fact, it's North Memoir, Wisconsin, because she actually grew up in River Falls, and where her father was a professor, mm-hmm. And also Mequon later for sad circumstances. And this is there are books that where a memoir is sort of cohesive and a general narrative, but then there's this thing, a memoir and essays, which they generally call a memoir, but I can tell the difference, and so can you if you pay attention. And what that is like the short story, like connected short story equivalent, where she's writing about the same subject mm-hmm. in different places, but it's a little more jumping around, and each story could have been published somewhere else, for example, like in a magazine.
Sure.
And so she had a very interesting experience. She grew up in an African true African-American family until when she was young, her father disappeared. He went home for a funeral and he didn't come back and he died.
Oh.
And the family didn't know exactly what happened. She was very close to her Gambian family, but the Nigerian part of her family was more removed. There was some, her uncle was very competitive. We don't really know what happened. There's little dips and pieces that come out through it. But meanwhile, she's living her own life. River Falls, needless to say, she was probably the only black family there. It was a very different experience. They moved to Mequon after her father died. Her mom was a doctor. There were 220 kids, the transfer kids. So there were black kids, but they didn't really accept her. So it's sort of something that a number of writers have talked about, like sort of not being in one group or another group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an adult, as the world has changed and as she's found different kinds of black people, she's sort of embraced it, her community. It's definitely she has some social media following, but this is a very well-written essay collection that veers from dating life to pop culture to family while she kind of lays out. So there's lots of other things to keep you interested while she lays out her story in terms of love, life, and family.
Mm-hmm.
So
again, that was Who I Always Was. When you pick up a memoir, are you more likely to go with one where you are familiar with the person writing it, as about, you know, it's Barbara Streisand or it's Cher or whatever?
Right.
Or are you more interested in stories that you probably don't know anything about?
It's funny because I have all kinds of arbitrary rules, and I used to call, like, what's the difference between a memoir and autobiography? And I was like, and I feel like an autobiography is more like it's got to be a famous person, like a person that you would know otherwise. And, you know, the Shares and Barbara Streisand's. I read a little bit of those, but even when I do, it tends to be somebody not at the height of fame. I'm interested at the margins. I read some like music memoirs, and I'm always most interested in what they were like before they were famous, and as Erica Jong after they're famous. So like one of the things I read, Peter Frampton's memoir last year, and first of all, it was interesting to me that he cooked up with David Bowie because David Bowie's father was his science teacher, but also that when his fame was done, as it is for most people, he said, well, I really like playing guitar in bands. And so he toured with bands. That was actually 2 years ago, because my last year I read Michael McDonald, and it was sort of the same thing. Michael McDonald, when he was trying to make it, he was sort of discovered by Steely Dan, played on the albums, he toured with them, but they didn't have a functioning band. He was a contract player. So what would he do? I think I've said this before somewhere in the world that goes out. He was in a Steely Dan cover band.
I love it.
Yeah. So I'm looking for also, I do sometimes check reviews, because the famous ones, we often don't get advanced copies. So I'm like you. I go into a bookstore, mine or somebody else's, and I say, you know, I really want to read that book. This book, Raising Hair, which is the next book I was going to talk about, was actually, I wasn't the first person to read it. It hit the bestseller list. Two of my booksellers who I work with, Tim and Kathy, really loved the book. And they kept trying, you know, Tim kept, you know, we recommend books to each other. We often read some overlap. And he kept saying, you're going to like this, you're going to like this. It's about a woman who is a policy specialist in Great Britain during COVID. She goes to her country home and she comes into contact with a baby hair, a leveret, I guess you call it, and touches in a way that sort of makes them nervous that the hair can't go back into the wild. Mm-hmm. But she kind of keeps her distance, and it certainly doesn't become a pet because it basically has the run of the place outside, but they definitely bond, and it does successfully mate in the wild and has babies and stuff, and she mixes science and nature and history with these observations about what it's like, the human connection with animals, for example. It was so good. And so I can see what everybody was saying, what it was. People compared it to Margaret Renkel, the nature writer. If there was ever a book I was going to recommend to Larry Mueller, it would be that one. And if it wasn't a thriller. So there's no thrills in the book. The most interesting thing about the book to me was there's been a lot of research. She kind of busts a lot of myths, and if nothing else, you know the difference between a hare and a rabbit, which I didn't really understand. But she was able to observe behavior that official studies had said doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting when you get the non-scientist's viewpoint of things sometimes. That was Raising Hair, Hare, by Chloe Dalton. And next up, we've got So Far Gone by Jess Walter. And that one sounds like it's really fun.
It's fun. It's a bit of a thriller. Mm-hmm. And sort of, you know, a literary thriller. Jess Walter wrote Beautiful Runes, which was a huge bestseller, and then A Cold Millions, which is historical fiction. He's been Edgar shortlisted. So basically, he never writes the same book twice. Like every book, like you never know what you're getting when you get a Jess Walter book. So this time, you've got a journalist who has gone off the grid, who has to, outside of Spokane, because Spokane is his home market, shall we say. When they're not set in Italy, they're usually in Eastern Washington State, which is cool because there's not that much written in that area. Mm-mm. Sherman Alexie, I think, has some stuff there. He kind of bands together with these various, you know, a journalist, and finds people to kind of go after these supremacists, shall we say, but finds that the world is much more complicated than the one he left behind.
Sure.
And once again, this time I read it and recommended it to Tim, who loved it. I know this book is coming out in June. I think it's going to get a lot of attention. He's a wonderful writer. If, you know, just to bring him back to a local connection, it reminded me of one of Larry Watson's books.
Okay.
There was also an abduction of grandchildren in it, and kind of that mix of, like, it's kind of a thriller but kind of a literary novel. My friend Lisa at Books and Company said it really reminded her of the classic writer Thomas McGuane, mm-hmm. and she said this is a great recommendation if she could just find someone who read Thomas McGuane. But we know they're out there.
I'm sure there are. If you, you should give us a call, 800-642-1234. Evelyn emailed us, and she's enjoying The Antidote by Karen Russell. The story takes place in Nebraska during the Dust Bowl days. It's a new concept for Evelyn. Prairie witches hold memories for folks who don't want to be burdened by them. There's a lot going on in this story, and it has captured her attention. Are you familiar?
I know the book. I didn't read it. I read Swamplandia, which was when Karen Russell was writing deep in the South. But you can see there's a, like, her books have so this is in Nebraska, but there's still not a, there's always a little kind of grotesque craziness to her stories. Mm-hmm. Reviews have been really spectacular, actually. And it's fascinating to be in the to take this 1930s Dust Bowl sort of setting, which I love.
Very interesting. I hadn't said the name of the other book we were talking about with the journalist who's off-grid, So Far Gone by Jess Walter, because people will call up and yell at me for not saying that. So next one up is Big Chief by John Hickey, and it's set in Wisconsin.
It is, and this is also my not exactly a thriller, but kind of a thriller segment. I really like these sort of political narrative thrillers, and normally the world reads them on a big stage, and for some reason I really like them on a small stage. So this is about a tribal election, and Mitch Caddo is a sort of a fixer for his childhood buddy Mac, who has become the head of this tribe. He was going to root out corruption and save everybody, but you know what, I don't know if you've ever seen this happen where a politician sort of promises one thing and then sort of instead goes after their enemies.
It's so unusual. Yes. I've never heard of that before.
So this is would be very enlightening for you to read this book, which is based on, the author is I think he's in the Lac de Flambeau, this is a fictional tribe in northern Wisconsin, but I will tell you, somebody told me they thought it was in Minnesota, and I said, no, they're very definitely near Wausau, and some of the courtroom scenes are in Milwaukee. So that was very exciting. So anyway, he gets a new rival, somebody else is going to run for election against him, and it turns out his adopted father, who's really pissed off at him now, is backing the other woman, Gloria, who's run for things in the past, but in a bigger stage is never. So she's a very well-known person, even though she hasn't really won elections before. And she's sort of off the page for most of the story, which I thought was a very clever thing. Then necessarily things have to get very heated, misunderstandings, backstabbing, rivalries, that kind of thing. One of my favorite books the year it came out was The Coyotes of Carthage, written by a Madison writer, Stephen Wright. And I thought, this had sort of the vibe of that book.
Okay.
And very Wisconsin-y. And in fact, one of the cases that he used, it turns out that there's one of our customers was a lawyer in the case, and so he came to the event.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I've always thought it was interesting. You're talking about the Big Chief by John Hickey. get that down there. But there's kind of a rivalry up for the northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin. There's a lot of books I've read that are kind of set in that area,
sure.
But you're not quite sure if it's Minnesota or Wisconsin. And when you figure out that it is Wisconsin, do you kind of get excited?
It's mostly Minnesota, though. Noticed that?
I know.
Yeah. Mostly.
Mostly.
But we adopt, you know what? The South takes the whole region.
True.
The South, New England.
Yep.
I would say Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan. We're the Upper Midwest.
That's right.
And we should be proud of our siblings.
That's right. And we're cool. We are talking about some wonderful books to read this summer with Daniel Golden from Boswell Books. And we'll be back after the news for much more. So stay with us. This is the Larry Mueller Show. Today we're talking about some books you may want to consider for your summer reading list. I'm Jill Nadeau, and of course, this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest today is Daniel Golden. It's so good to have him back because he loves to share his favorite books with us. And he's got a list of 20, and we're a little bit past halfway, so we got a few more good ones for you. Daniel's the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. And by the way, we have the list of all the books that Daniel mentions on our website. Just go to WPR.org/Larry, and it'll be listed under today's program. Who's your favorite author, or what genre would you like to get into this summer? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email. That's talk@WPR.org. And we've got a couple callers. So before we get back to your list, Daniel, let's go to the phones. Susie in Wausau, go ahead.
Frederick Bachman. He has a new book coming out. I don't know the name of it. I was just wondering if he's read it or what he thinks.
Well, we had two people read it in the store, my friends. They loved it. You know, it's about characters in a painting, and then the younger woman who tries to figure out who they were. It's got the same sort of philosophy and emotional heart and quirky observations that he has. I didn't read it. Two of our other books has read it, but we did host an event with him. So I was just around like 700 people who read it. Very obsessive, coming from all over the country to see him, because he was in the country for not that long.
Oh, wonderful. Well, congrats on that get, by the way.
I was very shocked and and thrilled, and everybody loved it. And we had an event the next day, and 30 people at that event had been to the one before.
Oh, my gosh.
Because it was the Rocky Lake Creatures. They were kind of similar.
Okay.
And so I'm like, I just, people kept saying, I was like, okay, I'm going to make everyone raise their hands. I'm figuring not everyone raised their hands. So. but yeah, Bachman is, like I said, the Kevin Wilson or the Satisfaction Cafe. I have a long list. How to Read a Book by Monica Wood. You know, there's just a lot of books in this sort of that really well written, kind of emotional, heartwarming and yet wrenching sort
sure.
of stories.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Susie. Again, that is My Friends by Frederick Bachman. Next up, we've got Jerry and Shell Lake. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hello. Yeah, I was wondering about Jonathan Franzen, one of my favorite authors, what he's been doing lately. Usually it's every 5 years or so he has a book. And he might have been involved in a lawsuit versus AI. That's about all I can say is Jonathan Franzen. What's he doing?
You know, I, oddly enough, I do know his last published book, which was not one of his novels. Weirdly enough, he translated a book from German with Jenny Watson, who teaches at Marquette, called The Short End of the Sonnenallee, came out in 2023. And that's probably wasn't on your radar, but this was a labor of love for him. Obviously, you don't hear of him translating many books. And I was like, you can translate German? But it was a very popular program that we did. I don't know. I know that he doesn't have a novel coming out this fall. There are a number of authors who write sort of in his vein. I know one of them is going to come to me pretty quickly, but maybe not. I know I can do it. I can do it. I can do it. It's a book that my coworker Chris really loves, and Stephen Markley. So I would suggest maybe trying a Stephen Markley book. One of them is called The Deluge. One of them is called Ohio. I definitely have recommended books that I have thought were in the Franzen-esque era. I know Long Island Compromise by Taff, the woman who wrote, Taffy. This is one of those names where I'm like, I'm not going to remember this name. Taffy Broadisser Ackner. Definitely people compare her to Franzen with a different, you know, a female perspective and a little different.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. Hopefully those recommendations will help you make up till we get the next one. I know. I think that we're all a little bit, I don't know what the word, we're demanding of the authors that we enjoy. We want more books.
Oh, goodness. And sometimes they come out with so many that you think maybe they should take an extra year. But other people, you know, we hosted the author Dream State this year, Eric Puckner. He had his mom lived in Wisconsin, so he did not come. It was just a virtual thing. I think there was an Oprah Book Club book, but I had thought, well, I read one of his books once, and it was like 15 years ago. That was his last novel.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, yeah.
Especially people who teach writing. They can get the contract, but they're often so busy teaching writing that they don't take time for themselves.
Sure. Well, let's go back to your list. We've got another mystery here, and this one's set in Chicago called The Case of the Missing Maid.
Yes, 1890 Chicago. So this person could have been on the train with the Paris Express if they had enough money to get out of the United States, which was probably unlikely. I'm always looking for mysteries to recommend, but the biggest issue is it's really hard to get somebody to start in the middle of a series,
true,
even though they are not like fantasy series where, you know, like it stops on one page and then you have to wait a year for what happens on the next page. Now, they're usually very discrete cases. When I was growing up, if this is one of my pet peeves, when I was growing up, I didn't read mystery books in order. I read Agatha Christie's However, the Hercule Poirot. I read P.D. James, mm-hmm, However. And now everybody's like, but what's the first one? But what's the first one? And I understand the first one is a setup, but I read books out of order periodically just to show that it can be done, but nobody listens to me. So this is the first book in a series, needless to say. Books reviews have been very good. It's Rob Osler, I think it's his second series that he's written. And it is about a young woman who would like nothing more to be a detective, but she can only get a job like as a bookkeeper. Her parents have died. She is taking care of her younger brother, who's still in school, and so they're very short on funds. But she gets she somehow connects with this agency, and they say, "Well, if you the owner of the agency says, well, you know, my neighbor is driving me crazy. She wants to know what happened, why the maid disappeared." And so if you figure it out, maybe I'll train you to be a detective. So needless to say, it is not so simple as she thought it was. And there's much intrigue. And on top of that, she is actually a lesbian. And in 1890 Chicago, not an easy thing to do. So she sort of has to sort of guard her identity. But she also is likes, for example, men's shoes and, you know, clothes, has found that it's very difficult to solve crimes in bustles. So,
yes,
so she's got that. What I really liked about this book, it's really a character. I've gotten a number of people to read it who really enjoyed it. There were some very nice reviews out there. It hit the USA Today bestseller list for a couple of weeks, but it's a little tough to get traction in that world without a television show or something like that. What I really like about it is it's a different side. I've read a ton of books set in Chicago, but it's a different side of Chicago because most of it is set in Polish downtown, which was on the north side, and it was the largest community of Poles outside of the area that would be Poland, but there was no Poland then. So it's a little hard to describe. And I really enjoyed it, that part of the book. Mm-hmm. I believe the book did well enough that there will be another book in the series. Mm-hmm. I
really like the series where there's a woman's, but it's set, you know, 100 years ago, but they act like they're from today.
Oh yeah, I what do I say that? What I say is a historical novel with modern sensibilities.
I like that. Very well put.
There's a series from a local Madison writer, Erica Ruth Neubauer, used to live in Milwaukee. And they're very much kind of feel like BBC mystery series. And she is and that's the way it is. Like she tries to be for the period, but she's much more aware of injustice than, say, many of those people would be at the time. Not all of them, but, you know, the odds are less aware of injustice. Yes. The first book on that is her first book is called, I want to say, because people, you know, Murder at the Mina House, because I will tell them that the new book's really good. But they're going to say, and what's the first one?
I've read it, actually. Yeah, yeah, it is very good. Yeah.
That what you were saying.
Yep. Mm-hmm,
you know, it's sure. Very period. It's got a lot of detail, but she's a kind of contemporary
heroine. She is. Yeah, those are my favorites. I love those. Next up, we have, and it's out today, Murder in the Dollhouse by Rich Cohen. This is true story?
Yes. And this is the true story of why I read it. So so it is classic true crime. Jennifer Dulos, if you watch News Nation's Ashley Banfield, like probably featured a lot if you lived in Connecticut. It was a woman from a very wealthy family who sort of had trouble finding herself. She dated a lot of men over the years. She really wanted a family, but nothing ever really stuck. And so when she got a little older, she met this guy who she went to college with, who she didn't know very well. And they wound up marrying. And then she's dead. And
Rich, a great summation.
Rich Cohen. It's a really interesting story. It is. I didn't read true crime when I was young because I was a delicate flower, but I do. I think I was sort of led back into it through the New Yorker writers like David Graham and Patrick Radden Keefe, who were kind of telling sort of bigger stories with what were basically crime narratives. And so finally this year, because I read at least one old book a month, which is 3 years for me, which is not old for anybody else, but that's when you're a bookseller, that's very old. Uh-huh. But I wound up going back and reading In Cold Blood.
I've read that late. You know what I mean, too.
Before me.
Yes, before you.
But, you know, it was sort of like I'm reading all these books that are supposed to be good true crime books. I got to go to the one that transcended the genre, that did it. And it was this, you know, you read some books, old books, and you go, ooh, you're not supposed to say this anymore. Ooh,
yeah,
we don't do that.
Cringy.
And it wasn't cringy at all. Mm-hmm. And all I could, you know, there are some cringy things in Breakfast at Tiffany's. That's why I was like thinking about that. But nothing. And I also read the Casey Sett book about how Truman Capote wrote In Cold Blood. Mm-hmm. It led me. I was like, well, I got to read another. And so oddly, Rich Cohen has a column for The Wall Street Journal. And I've actually read his books before. And he wrote a book about Cumberland Packing, which was Sweet and Low, the sugar packets, the artificial sugar packets. He wrote a book about Chess Records. But all his books always have some connection to Rich. And so, yeah, there's a little thing. And, you know, he lives in that part of Connecticut. So he was several degrees of separation. Very classic true crime. Out today. We'll see what the reviews are like, because it's interesting for me because very classic true crime often doesn't get traditional review attention. They lean on Goodreads and social media and that kind of thing. But Rich Cohen would get reviews. And so this book is very much in that thing. If you learn one thing from this book, it's somebody's got to reform the divorce laws in Connecticut, because there's a lot of feeling that that particular court district leads to much more contentious divorces than the districts around it. Isn't that interesting?
That
you think about how a court can lead to murder.
Ah, wow. That sounds like a book. And this particular book is called Murder in the Dollhouse by Rich Cohn. And we're talking to Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company. If you've got some books to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hope you can join us tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. PJ Leish is back to answer your questions about insects. He's got a new one that's sort of invading the state, and it's called Asian, some kind of ant. And I'm sorry, I forgot, but it'll be really interesting to hear about that. Plus, then we're going to talk about the value of wetlands as we celebrate American Wetlands Month. Right now, we are talking about books, and we were just talking about a true crime novel. And Claire actually sent this in to ask you about, she said she's heard critics of true crime say it's the lowest form of entertainment. And she's wondering what you make of that. And what about true crime really fascinates us? That's always been a question on my mind, too.
It's also especially because of the resurgence. I mean, it was one of those
crazy.
In the 70s, like we probably didn't have a true crime section that you would go to the chain store for that. I was volunteering at a bookstore for Thanksgiving one year, and somebody asked me about true crime, and the person looked at me and was like, we don't have that section. But but I was able to think of a couple of crimey books that I could come to. I really like the novel I Have Some Questions for You by Rebecca Mackay, which is about a woman who is involved in a true crime podcast for a school. Like, she comes back to kind of help the kids. And it raises a lot of these questions, especially like, why are there so many, you know, young women obsessed with true crime? I've had authors have been using this as, I think Ashley Winstead's last novel was about true crime. And I'm trying to think of another Chicago writer it's called This Book Will Bury Me. And that's also true crime centered. So it is, you know, I feel like it's sort of similar to people's fascination with horror movies. Stimulates you in a certain way with still some distance. You can have those kind of feelings, but because it's generally set in the past, like you're not watching, the people are obsessed with the trials too. Like I said, there's at least one talk show that's all it is true crime. And there's many talk shows that are mostly true crime.
And there's so many podcasts, which
podcasts,
I think.
Explosion.
Yeah,
we've hosted a few of them.
Have you?
So, there are a lot to go around. You can have some yourself.
There certainly are. Okay, well, let's go to the phone. We've got Annie and Nina. Go ahead, Annie.
Hi. This book, Lula Dean's Little Library of Banned Books, was written in 2024, and politically it's right on the money. She writes a satire that will have you groaning and laughing, and I will just tell you that in the beginning, this Lula Dean is not a well-loved person in the community, and she puts out in front of her house a little box on a stick and puts books in it. And the story takes place in a small town in southern Georgia. And all of her books have to do with etiquette for a lady in southern times. And the book is current, though, in terms of its placement in our time. And she puts books in about etiquette and how to bake and how to be a proper wife and mother. Well, the woman in the city who is on the library board and has been stuck with the job of taking out all the books that Lula Dean thinks should be banned from the library, they're in this other lady's basement. And this lady who's holding the books until the library board decides what to do about it, her daughter is away in college and comes home for a weekend, and she discovers this library of Lula Dean's. And she takes, in the middle of the night, she and a friend of hers take out all Lula Dean's books, take the covers off of them, and put those covers on books that were in her mother's basement that Lula Dean wanted banned. And then they disappear, leaving all these other books in there. And so what happens is the community, one by one and little by little, borrow a book from Lula Dean's collection. And when they get home, of course, they realize, the book I'm reading is not the one that the cover says it is, but they like what they're reading. And there is, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. And I think Lord of the Flies or Catcher in the Rye. I mean, there are a lot of the books that some people would like to see our children not be able to read right now.
Wow, that sounds really interesting, Annie. We really appreciate you calling in about that. Are you familiar?
Yeah, it came out last year. It's going to be in paperback this year.
Okay.
And it is, you're so right, caller, that it is so much about things in the news with libraries and even bookstores. Texas is coming up, has a battle where they're trying to allow people to sue for books that they don't want in a bookstore. And a lot of times, you know, when you see some of these libraries, like in South Carolina, there it's often one person pulling most of the books. And so it is, you know, it's satire, but is it satire?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
But I know it's got a humor to the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people do love books about books. And effectively, I guess her little library is like a bookstore library. It's a subsidiary of the bookstore library genre.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Thanks, Annie. So let's get back to your list again. Next one up is Losing Big by Jonathan Cohen. It's about sports gambling. And actually, he appeared on Wisconsin, or not appeared, but he was on Wisconsin Today not that long ago. And so anybody wants to listen to him, they can look for him on our website, WPR.com. But so tell us about Losing Big.
Yeah, everybody should probably, I'm going to go back and listen to that recording as well. It is a book that I heard about, and let me say, this is the kind of book that no publisher is trying to get me to read. I actually browsed the store and bought it myself and read it and passed it to my brother-in-law as a lawyer. And then I got another copy for myself. I also wanted to make the argument that, you know, like I kind of divide nonfiction into like surveys and thesis and narrative, you know, like those are sort of the things. And I did mention my complaint about not being lectured to. So I just wanted to say, well, sometimes I can be lectured to. And basically what he says is, you know, he doesn't say we should ban sports gambling, that chicken is out of the coop or whatever you'd say, but that we're really not paying attention to the ill effects of it, and that nobody seems to take, you know, very little responsibility. I know different states have different laws that are pretty inconsistent and things change and things like that. But, you know, there's just a resurgence of gambling among young people. The barriers to entry, like so much in the internet, are down. And I, you know, I've always been, you know, I'm not a moral hard ass, but I gambling has always worried me, you know, like I've seen sort of the ill effects of it and people who've really struggled as a result. And it is an addiction like anything else. So I just, it's a pretty succinct book, but I thought it was important reading.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all.
Okay. Well, definitely. It's called Losing Big by Jonathan D. Cohen. Now, next up, we've got, I love the name of this, Every Tom, Dick, and Harry by Eleanor Lipman. Rom-com?
Yeah. You know, this is funny you say that. So I always used to call her rom-com. And I'd say, you know, with the resurgence of romance, I'd say, well, this is a romance. And Ellie, who's from the old school and more literary, would say, no, it's not. And I would say, it is, you know, I would say, no, it, you know, like what, you know, what are the rules of romance? And there is one way, and it's not like a romance, because now that we have a romance book club and romance sections, and Milwaukee's got two romance bookstores, and there's a romance festival in September, I've learned that one of the things, romance is very self-aware, and so one of the things that is very important in romance is tropes. And, like, there's all these different tropes, and there's good tropes, and there's bad tropes, and, like, nobody likes the cheating trope, but everybody likes the enemies to lovers trope. And, and I would say that this is a book where it's like a romance because you know that she's going to wind up with the guy at the end, but there isn't that sort of playfulness. It's sort of taken for granted. And nowadays, having just rewatched the entire first, you know, the original Frasier, which I never did for some reason, even though I've read a lot, watched a lot of, I'm very, very conversational about other sitcoms. Uh-huh. For some reason, at the time, it wasn't interesting to me. But now that I've read it, I realize the best parts of Frasier are not, well, it's not a, it is a romantic comedy if Niles was the star, Nas and Daphne, but it's farce. It's high farce. It's like Noises Off. It's like a lot of British comedies. Mm-hmm. Slamming Doors and Miscommunication and Double Identities and, you know, Shakespearean almost, totally. If you would say.
Yeah.
And that's what this book is. And it is about a young woman, Emma, who is, you know, I've read everything Eleanor Lipman writes, so, you know, I've been following, reading her forever. And this is about a woman who inherits a vintage estate sale business from her parents and or from her dad and stepmom. And the first thing she does is rename it. And she's Ellie has a very good way with names. So it was called Finders Keepers. She said, no, I have to make it my own. She calls it a state of mind. And so she's going to is going to make it in Harrow, which is a fictional version of Northampton, which she always uses as the big city. There, Boston is Boston, New York is New York, but for some reason, Northampton's small enough that it gets another name. And she's going to have her first big sale. There's a competitor in town. You know, they're at each other's throats, but she gets this big mansion, and it was a B&B, and it's got all sorts of great stuff in it. And then someone says, oh, by the way, it was kind of a house of ill repute as well. So, and like, why didn't the police chief shut it down? Well, there's something about Massachusetts laws, and they followed this one, and they followed that one. But also, it was owned by the last police chief's wife.
So that might have something to do with it.
That has the complication. Characters returning. It's really fun.
It sounds fun. I love those kind of books. And then coming up after that, Shop Girls by Jessica Anya Blau.
So unlike Ellie, I haven't read all of Jessica Anya Blau's books, but I loved her last book enough, Mary Jane, that I went backwards and read another one. And that, for a bookseller, is very rare. Mm. I shouldn't have you know. Mary Jane was sort of coming-of-age story set in Maryland. It was sort of a little bit of a take between Anne Tyler and Snow White. This book is set in the 1980s, and it's also this innocent yet knowing young woman. That's sort of Blau's specialty, who gets a job at iMagnon, and if those are a certain age, fancy department store. Woo-hoo. In San Francisco.
Yes.
Really snazzy, and it's a dream, and she works in better dresses, and she's with this community of salespeople, and some are really wonderful, and some are really mean, and she really dreams of having, maybe someday she'll get to be a buyer or something, but the family pulls on her. She's grown up really poor, and her mom's like, this is a waste of your money. You could get paid better if you worked in a home improvement store like I do. So there is that sort of mother-daughter bond. There's not that much plot to the story, but the relationships are so wonderful, especially the women friendships. The woman that she lives with, who's a lawyer, and her coworker, who's an older Russian refugee. And there are this running scenes where they make little finger, like paper dolls for all the people they work with and all their regular customers and act out the scenes. That is just like, you're just screaming from laughter and also just feeling so good about it. Uh-huh. And there is a little plot, but I'll just say it's much more period. Anyone who knows me well knows I am a sucker for all department stores as well. But I'll just say iMagnon was more of a specialty store. It didn't have like furniture and toys and
that's
stuff.
Right.
So,
right.
But, and there was one, they were in Chicago in the day.
Yeah.
So I asked your aunt.
I was there and I felt very intimidated.
Yes. It is one of those stores where you're like, should I be here?
I shouldn't even be here. They can tell, right? They can tell I'm not going to buy something.
So you need lessons in how to act rich.
Now I could pull it off. But at the time, you know, a college student, no way, no way. I stick with Boston store and Gimbel. Anyway, so I was going to say, you know, we're talking about Do you like books that make you laugh out loud?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
In fact, I really should keep a laughometer for how many times I laughed out loud. And of course, you know, the laughing is sort of, there's a little psychology of laughing. And so people are more likely to laugh in when there's someone around to see them laughing, you know, in a public space. That's why it's so much more fun, even though we all do everything at home now. Why movies? Like, there should be a resurgence of comedies like thrillers. It's more fun to laugh in a group.
That is very true.
And
yeah.
So why isn't anyone understanding this and having more comedies in theaters?
But they are adding comedy to a lot of movies that are coming out.
Well, right. And
right,
actually,
you know,
the superhero movies are funny now, right?
They are. Yeah, that's the only reason I go.
For the laughs.
I just went to the next Avengers, the new Avengers one, and I'm not big into those, but I love them because they're so funny, and this one was very funny. So,
oh, very nice.
Yes. Anyway, how do we get into movies?
We're talking about too.
We can do everything here, but we'd really like to hear from you, too, with your recommendations, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Neil emailed us, and he recommends Back Road Grace by Scott Stowell. Scott's an author from Ely, Minnesota, and his book is a collection of short stories from that area, his personal life and the natural world. Neil said it's a really well-done collection, providing humor, humility, and perspective about his outdoor adventures. That one sounds really familiar to me.
And yet, I don't know it at all.
Hmm.
We're learning.
We're learning, always. Oh, my gosh. That's why I love it when you're on, because you always bring in authors I've never heard of before. And so it's always really great. And so let's go to your next one. This sounds really kind of interesting. It's called Food Person by Adam Roberts.
Well, this is a little grouping together again. So kind of they're all sort of these young women. I was talking to this with my coworkers, and I said, well, they're not romances. They're like falling in love with yourself.
Oh, lovely.
So coming of age kind of story.
Sure.
So this is a comedy. This is a laugh out loud book. It's about Isabella works at we're talking about department stores. Let's talk about magazines. So she works at a food magazine, maybe digital first. There's some, you know, video segments and things like that. And she is really wants to write cookbooks. She goes, her close friend runs a cookbook store, old cookbooks. She likes to cook out of old cookbooks. And she gets a big break to do a segment because somebody can't do it. And it goes terribly wrong. And she gets fired. But her roommate, who is an agent, says, I've got a deal for you. Why don't you ghostwrite a cookbook for this one of my charges?
Mm-hmm.
She's an actress who sort of isn't in a show right now, but is looking for a big comeback and did some food segments on YouTube and they blew up. And the only problem is she says yes because she doesn't have much choice in the matter. Only her Molly, who is the celebrity, really can't be predicted as to whether she's going to be really nice or really crazy. Like, and also she's not a good cook and has bad taste in food because she has a lot of family issues. So how will this work? I leave it for you
to figure it out.
So this author is actually coming. Adam Roberts is a food writer.
Uh-huh.
He's coming to Inklink for their food series, but it sells out in like a second. That's in East Troy.
Oh.
And so you got to get on their list because they open it up and they go really fast. They make a meal around the book.
Oh, that's really cool. You know,
this is one I would probably have gone to but you got to be fast.
Yeah. So you've got to be so thrilled with the resurgence and popularity of bookstores.
It is terrific. You know, when we opened, they said books wouldn't be around by 2014. No
mm-hmm.
books, no physical books, no bookstores. And now it's really where so many other things are going digital. People still like to read books. Not everybody likes to read books. And in fact, at the same time, you're seeing more bookstores open. You're seeing studies like, you know, kids can't, you know, college students can't be assigned books because they can't read them, or, you know, a very small percentage of teenage boys read a book in a year. And so there are mixed messages coming out there. A lot of the new bookstores are very mission-based and genre-focused. I hope they're also learning how to run a business, because they're two different skills. It was something that was very difficult for me. And, you know, things like business plans, things like how are you going to get your money, things like, you know, how are you going to juggle your expenses, how are you going to make the store on a limited budget look interesting enough for somebody to browse. So think about those things for the 10,000 of you who are opening bookstores in the next year.
And there's, you always, you know, they either want to write a book, which I think a lot of people don't understand how difficult that is, too, or open a bookshop.
Or both. Why not?
And then add a coffee shop at the same time. Right.
Also very different skills. I always people seem to do it, but one of my rules when I opened a bookstore, I was like, we ain't having a coffee shop. So we were fortunate enough to be connected to to a coffee shop, but it's not mine.
You don't have to worry about it.
And there's a door. There's a door.
I love it. Well, we are talking with Daniel Golden. He's the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. If you've got a book to recommend or a question for Daniel, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Just a reminder that tomorrow on the show, PJ Leash is going to be back to talk about insects. It's always interesting to have him with us. And then we're going to talk about the value of wetlands as we celebrate American Wetlands Month. And right now, of course, we are talking about books. Daniel Golden is in with his list of 20 good leads for the summer. We did get an email wondering if you have any tips for book storage with it getting hotter and humid. What's a good way to, they get moldy.
Oh, I know. This is not, well, I will say the biggest problem that in, you know, bookstore related is that the quality of paper is so bad. So the better the paper, acid-free, the more likely your books are going to last. But you'll find that sun is a big villain. I would say if they're not in a well-used room, I mean, I do dust my bookshelves periodically, but if you're storing them somewhere else, better to put them in maybe a box or a box within a box for mold, and don't put them in a place with a lot of mold. But sun, you know, like we just see so many books. We put books in the window to promote events, and some of them are just destroyed in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I'm not an expert on that, unfortunately. That's like when people ask me about antiquarian books, and I was like, I don't know. I think there's a website for it. And sadly, there's not. You know, there was Constant Reader was a wonderful antiquarian bookstore. And, you know, we send folks to, you know, the downtown books. But I don't know if that's, you know, there are other cities have these wonderful experts.
Yes.
You know, and I have somebody in my coffee shop next door who's an expert, but he's in his 80s. So, you know, he's going to, he's not running around town
looking
pricing
for stuff,
things.
Right. the bookstore I was at this weekend has a little bit of both, and they have coffee too.
Yeah.
But maybe in a small town, you probably can get away with that a little bit.
You know what?
More.
Everybody there for every rule, there's somebody breaking the rule who's doing an amazing job.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm sure, what is it, Literatus?
Yeah.
Yeah. In Waterford.
Watertown.
Watertown, right. Mm-hmm. Oh, Waterford is read by the river. Uh-huh. They each have bookstores. So this is my model. If you're a town in Wisconsin, you're thinking, I would like a bookstore to come, you should change the name of your town to Water something.
Yeah, that's true. There's so many. And then there's Waterloo, too. I don't know if they have a bookstore, though.
But maybe they do.
They should.
Yeah, they should. People are now, the wheels are turning.
The wheels are turning. Absolutely. Okay, so we've got one more book.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see.
In the lightning round. No.
Yeah. It's Almost Always Sunny in Philadelphia by Kimberly Potts.
Well, so needless to say, publishers send us a lot of books.
Sure.
And mostly fiction, mostly by writers you never heard of.
Uh-huh.
Or people maybe you heard of, sort of, and they want to break out. They don't really need us to read, you know, like I'm probably not getting the next Jonathan Franzen Galley, sure. so to speak. Yeah. Sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, like, some, you know, if you're, sometimes if you get, because the media, a lot of books are done for just the media, but not for bookstores. Mm-hmm. So just recently I was given an advance memoir from Edward Hirsch, the writer, and the you know, I was told this is not, like, this is a rare galley.
Oh,
so
okay.
it's about growing up in Chicago. I'm kind of excited about it.
Uh-huh.
We get, you know, it depends on the publisher. And so we don't usually get a book about, like, pop culture like this, but I like them. And I thought, it's always Sunny in Philadelphia is, a really interesting, show for me because it was, started on a shoestring. It is the longest running comedy. It breaks the boundaries of taste constantly, and yet only a few episodes have been pulled from circulation. Have there been episodes pulled from circulation? Of course there have, but not as many as you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
And I also love books that have show the connections behind the scenes. It's similar to the music books. I was like, the fact that Charlie Day, who's one of the principals, was in the Williamstown Theater Festival, he's like, so many of the people, the writers and things, also came from that festival. He's good friends with, I think, the actor Sterling Brown from This Is Us, and who's also they're festival buddies. And so I sort of love that. And I also find it fascinating that all the principals work on, they have so much energy. They didn't have a writer's room till the third season. And they also all have other projects that they're doing at the same time. They were inspired by Curb Your Enthusiasm. And so the original show was actually actors in Los Angeles. That was the pilot, which they did for $200. And the studio, when they finally found John Landgraf at FX, who's like one of the few linear cable operations that is still successful, he said, too much. There's too much actors in L.A., which is how they wound up running a bar. I thought nobody, you know, my customers, I don't know who's reading this stuff. I was sitting at a literary lunch for the library, and I said to the woman across, because I say it to everyone, I said it to you.
Yes.
I had to write down, what is the name, Juliet Blackwood?
Blackwell.
I'm like, okay, got to check her out. Got to read another Wendy Webb. And I said, so what are you reading? She said, I'm reading that book about the Big Bang Theory. And I'm like, what? I want to read that book. Because then we had a discussion about why it didn't do it. You know, because the Friends book and the Seinfeld book, you know, hit the bestseller list. Sure. Why didn't that? It was biggest sitcom of all times. Yeah. And so then I told her about this book. It's just, you know, it's in a way, there's a lot of secondary sources and stuff. She interviewed about 30 people for this book, mm-hmm. but not the stars and not the directors, because they have their own book.
Of course.
She interviewed weird kind of side characters. Wade Boggs, she interviewed for the book. He's been in several episodes, you know.
Oh, really? I've never watched it, just because it's on on cable, because I don't have cable. So,
well, it's on streaming, too, now.
Is it?
It's on Hulu.
But I don't have Hulu either, no. But yeah.
You can do it. You can. I want to tell you. After the thing is out, I'll show you other ways to watch.
Okay.
But I do have cable, so uh-huh. What can I say? I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's a lot of them that seem to have come out, and some do well, some don't. I mean, we interviewed Jim Abrams and the two Zucker brothers about their book that came out not too long ago.
Well, it was big in Milwaukee.
It was huge in Milwaukee. I don't know how it did elsewhere.
I don't know.
But yeah, it's kind of interesting why some do well and some don't.
They had a bit of an airplane resurgence, you know, that is still another movie that seemingly is in bad taste and you wouldn't be able to show anymore.
Oh, right.
But it's so in bad taste that it's in good taste.
Yes, exactly.
And
they cornered that market.
They're Whitefish Bay's own. So yeah,
yes.
I mean, they, you know, I had just read a book from, you know, an old director. I do really like the behind the scenes
mm-hmm,
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've got one I've been trying to read on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but I just can't get through it.
Oh no.
So anyway, that one was called again.
It's Almost Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
That's right.
I believe they changed the name because I believe it originally, I'm going to just say, you know, and this happens when books come out that sometimes in the time that I read it. I mean, I obviously don't know. One of these books in June might be a big book club pick for Oprah or Reese or Reed with Jen or GMA. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They don't tell me. Sometimes they tell the buyer. A book club, so A-list book club is Reese and Oprah,
okay,
and the B book club is Jenna and GMA and maybe some others. And they'll sometimes find out, like, choice of two, duh. But and also, you know, that each of the groups picks certain kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a buyer. I don't know. I buy the greeting cards. There's no, I don't get anything.
I buy the greeting cards.
So they changed the cover. It's Always Sunny, and now it's almost always.
Almost
sunny.
Always. Yeah, there's probably a copyright thingy going on.
Plus rain. Sometimes it's snowing.
That's true.
It's Philadelphia. They get some bad weather.
They do.
Thank you. I am actually really excited for the sunny Abbott Elementary crossover, because they had the first half this year where they were doing, the Sunny people were doing community service at Abbott Elementary, and now there's going to be one.
I love it when shows do that.
I love a good crossover. We were talking about with books, we like when authors cross characters over. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big thing in romance, certainly. But
yes,
like, you know, one of my idols, Barbara Pym, did it occasionally. So
yeah,
it's got a long and storied history.
It does. And let's go to the phone. We've got Tom in Stoughton who has got a recommendation. Go right ahead, Tom.
Hey, guys. I actually have an old book. It was, and I don't know if you've heard of it before, but a man named Milton Meyer had written a book. They thought they were free, and it's basically the Germans from 1933 to 45, and it's kind of an interview, a life interview of 10 people that became Nazis, a tailor, a cabinet maker, school teacher, a student, a baker, a policeman, and basically follows them through that period of time. And what happened, the book was actually written in 55, so 10 years after the war, and I think it's been revised twice, 66, and I think in the 1970s. But it's really, it's a book that, like, every time I open it and read a different chapter, I learn something different.
Wow.
Which is really fun for kind of a textbook reader kind of guy. But anyway, so that would be my current pick.
It is still readily available, and it actually was last reissued in 2017, and it's actually selling as, you know, On Tyranny and many other, but I obviously, needless to say, I kind of stayed away from politics here.
Mm-hmm.
This book is actually selling really well right now. Mm-hmm. So,
well, thank you for bringing that to our attention, Tom. We really appreciate it. Again, that was They Thought They Were Free by Milton Meyer. And again, if you missed the name of one of these books that we talked about, you have a couple of options. You can go onto our website, wpr.org/Larry, and under today's program note, there will be a link, and then you can look at the list with the author and the name. Or you can always re-listen to this very amusing and entertaining interview that we just did. And you can listen to it again, as you can with all of our shows. It goes back for years and years and years. So you can say, hey, I remember in 2010 that Larry talked to so-and-so. And
you find it.
You can find it. Yeah, it's really interesting. We get requests a lot for that. So anyway, wonderful list. What's coming up at Boswell Book Company event-wise?
Well, Thursday I get to do a luncheon with a historical fiction writer I really like. Her name is Renee Rosen, and she started by doing a lot of Chicago history, something about the Tribune. She also, I think, did a Chess Records book. And then she started doing things outside of Chicago and New York. Her new book is called Let's Call Her Barbie. And it is the story of the Mattel toy company and Ruth Handler in particular, and what happened when her chief engineer started taking credit for the doll, and is very much a swinging 60s kind of story. I love her books because they put, she did a book about Estee Lauder. She did a book about Helen Gurley Brown. They always center on like an everyday person, a fictional kind of narrative or story that like puts her in with the real people. And so you get not just what was going on, but also what, you know, you get this coming of age story at the same time. You do have to be careful. And what I really like about Renee's stuff is that she gives you a lot of information on exactly what's real and exactly what isn't. Jennifer Chiarini, who sometimes does a show when she does her historical fiction, yes. She's doing quote books now, mm-hmm. but when she does her historical fiction, she's very careful about that too. I mean, she's the most careful person in the universe about that. but I just read a book called The Secret War of Julia Child based on popular demand. I saw us selling it and I thought, well, I could talk about Julia Child and her work in the service.
World War II.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And but you have to be very careful before you quote stories at cocktail parties, because there's a lot of it is speculative. Like what exactly happened? What didn't happen? Mm-hmm. Did she meet her husband, Paul, there? Absolutely. Did she jump out of a plane crashing? No, she didn't.
There should be a law against people being able to say that they did stuff like that.
Well, then you're going to kind of be anti. Which is not. It's fiction.
That's okay, if it's fiction. Okay, all right.
Well,
all
that's
right.
What, you know, we read. I read a lot of fiction. We're leaving, but I will just say, sometimes you can tell more truth with fiction than you can with nonfiction.
I love that. Should be on a t-shirt. Thank you so much, Daniel. We'll really appreciate you being with us. And thank you all for listening today. Thanks to our team for creating our shows every day. Claren Neipert, Joel Patton-Odd, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. I'm executive producer Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us.